Hello, and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. Today's topic relates to the mediation technique of using decision trees. We'll talk about how decision trees enable lawyers and mediators to map, then discuss the critical points in the party's litigation alternatives. We'll also learn how decision trees can be used within client counseling and the mediation process to move parties' psychological anchors, reduce loss perceptions, and improve communications around numbers and case assessments. The views expressed by the guests of this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 12. Our topic is decision tree analysis for lawyers, mediators, and their clients. Joining me today is Professor Marjorie Corman Aaron. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on your recently published book, Risk and Rigor, A Lawyer's Guide to Decision Trees for Assessing Cases and Advising Clients. That was released in 2019, correct?
Correct.
Well, what can you tell listeners about your book?
Well, I actually originally wrote the book because I wanted to talk about some of the more technical or requiring judgment aspects of using decision trees in a relatively complicated case. But then I realized that I needed to include everything, soup to nuts, for someone who had never studied the method before. And I wanted to be sure that the book walked people through the process and also explained how it is that they could use it, that it's not a good in and of itself unless it helps better lawyering and better mediating.
So it has some practical tips in it and really how to get into the nuts and bolts.
Yes, absolutely right. Both. So the simple part, the nuts and bolts, and then some advice on how you integrate it into practice.
Oh, great. And that's actually your second book, correct? Your first book, Client Science, Advice for Lawyers on Counseling Clients Through the Bad News and Other Legal Realities, that came out in 2012. I think it, like, writing a book to me is just not, I can't even picture going through that. Do you have any advice for new academic authors who are breaking into book writing?
Well, my advice for anybody, not anybody, is to chain yourself to your chair and lock the refrigerator.
I need that advice now for working at home in the pandemic, that refrigerator. Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. And even a lot of this book, I mean, when you teach a lot of, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, a lot of the substantial writing happens during the summer when you're not teaching. And then there's maybe in an additional chapter or a lot of editing and moving things around and filling things in that you didn't get on the first draft. That tends to happen during the course of the school year. So even before pandemic, if it was summertime, I was probably sitting at my desk trying to write it. Mm-hmm. Actually, this was written in part in the library in Stockholm.
Oh, interesting. Is that a good place to write?
It is. Well, my husband and I, since we're both academics, we figured out after our kids were out of the house and even a little bit before when they were in summer camp that we could go somewhere for a month in the summer. And he writes too. So we would get an Airbnb or rent an apartment from a friend and then trot ourselves off to the whatever the public library was and write during the day and then, you know, explore.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So a lot of this was written in the King's Library in Stockholm.
Oh my gosh, how amazing. Stockholm's on my list of places to visit. That sounds awesome. Let's talk a second about your background. You graduated from Princeton University and from Harvard Law School, and you actually worked at Harvard as well, correct?
Correct. So after I had been in practice for quite a while, I had been a litigator, a civil, and then an assistant DA. And then I joined a company that was then called End Dispute and later merged with JAMS. But that's where I learned to mediate and more broadly about the practice field of dispute resolution. But through one thing and another, I ended up really being asked to apply to be the executive director at PON, the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School. And that's where I was really first introduced to the academic side of the dispute resolution field. But I came to it with a strong background in practicing mediation. So that's when I worked at Harvard, and I was working there, always maintained a little private practice in mediation and things like that on the side, but I was working at the Program on Negotiation and met and became pretty much immersed in a lot of the academic writing in the dispute resolution field, and then moved with my family to Cincinnati, Ohio in 1998, really because my husband got the job of his dreams, but I had the contact at UC.
Yeah, we're lucky to have you here in Ohio, professor and director of the Center for Practice at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. And you coach students, teams of students who are participating in negotiations and DR competitions, right? What do you like about that? Have you been there for a while?
It's fun. You know, I teach those things, and it's fun to take a student who has a strong interest in the field and then work with them really closely on a particular simulation or problem to see how much they can progress and how much they can see, you know, that there might be alternative approaches if you spend concentrated time. So it's not as much about the winning as it is about the process. I've actually lately been teaching and coaching in trial practice, which is kind of funny because it's something I did a long time ago, but I enjoy that as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, a little different techniques than negotiation, but you still have to prepare and think on your feet.
Right, exactly right. Yep.
And are you ready to dive into our topic today? All right.
I think I'm ready.
All right. There is a field of study called decision tree analysis. And what is decision tree analysis?
Decision tree analysis uses a basic logic that says, the way I make a decision often has to do with thinking about, well, what are the possible things that could happen if I make a decision one way? And if I make a decision to go in a certain direction, what are the possible things that could happen? And if one or another of those things happen, what are the consequences likely to be? And how will that unfold over time? So it basically deconstructs a decision or the predicted path of a course of action and breaks it down into smaller parts so that you can examine it more closely. It's not a new field at all. It was one of the founders of it was Howard Rafa, who passed away at the ripe age of 90 something, not that long ago. He was a mathematician and a decision scientist and a professor, both some part of Harvard University General, as well as in the mathematics and at the Harvard Business School. I actually knew Howard's writing before I started working with him. He was a prince of a man, a wonderful, wonderful man. But the notion that one should look at the risks and the costs of doing something, you know, is not new as a general idea, and a decision analysis, something that has been taught in business schools for quite a while.
Okay. And can it be used for mediation or other legal uses?
Yes. I mean, I think I was introduced to it probably in 1988 or so when I started at End Dispute, because the gentleman that I worked with in that very small company, we used it. And we used it in a mediation context. So I was first introduced to it in the context of a mediation, but I also teach it to my students in a client counseling course.
Okay. Can you tell us about using the visual of the diagram of a decision tree, using that visual aid, or how that works?
Yes. I mean, let me just say that. So the idea that one would look at risks and gains, you know, could you do that on a little scratch pad or on an Excel spreadsheet? Are there ways to accomplish some of the math that's in a decision tree that way? The answer is yes. But I have over the years come to the pretty strong position that a good part of the value of the process when working with clients, either in mediation or in counseling the client as the client's lawyer, has to do with the visual. for a couple of reasons, but one of them is that it forces either lawyer or mediator or both to slow down when you're explaining what might happen. So if we think about it, lawyers used to write, write opinion letters, which would say, well, if this happens and that happens, and they used to be pretty detailed, at least way back in the day when I remember writing them. But I'm not sure a client could see or really understand how things would unfold. And it also, without the visual, it's harder to see how one issue relates to another. So for the purposes of client counseling, instead of the lawyers or mediation, well, you know, this could happen and they're waving their arms and then that could happen and then you never know and then this and then could be that. And it, when you have it mapped out in front of you, the way a process might flow, it's easier to understand and to take in the whole. It's easier to see how the parts relate to one another. And then literally in the conversation, as the mediator or the lawyer talks with the client about each separate thing that might happen and their assessment of the chances of it happening, that slows the conversation down. It allows for a space for the client to ask questions, for there to be dialogue about why this probability and not something else. It creates a lot of space for face saving in a funny way. And I can go into it more later, apart from the visual, but it also, in a funny way, when you have a decision tree on a piece of paper or on a computer screen, and the mediator and the client, or the lawyer and the client, are sitting side by side and they're looking at that piece of paper, or they're looking at a screen that shows a decision tree that's been mapped out for a case, it actually almost becomes a mediator. So if I'm looking at you directly and you say, let's say I'm the lawyer and you're my client, and you say, well, surely, you know, of course we're going to win that, whatever we're going to win. And I say, well, it's possible, but I have to tell you that I think that because of that manager that you have who isn't going to come off very well at trial, I'm not sure that we even have a 50-50 chance of winning that. I think the odds are lower. Mm-hmm. Well, that's almost a direct, if I say that to you directly, that's sort of a direct assault.
Hard to hear that kind of information.
Oh yeah. And you can get involved in a tussle that way. There's an emotional content to it. Whereas if I've explained the method and I have a decision tree mapped out and we're both looking at that tree, I've engaged you, first of all, in a cerebral exercise, mm-hmm. which is a good thing. I'm using language that's a little less emotional for you to hear. And we're both looking at this thing. And I say, so here, and I point down at it, here is where I see that there's a problem, because that manager, it's a little less confrontational, but also undeniable, because there it is on piece of paper.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of one of the things that you said in your writings, that decision tree analysis can turn battles into business plans. And
you know,
I love that.
I read that you said that on some of the notes, and I thought, I don't remember that line,
yes, but that's like exactly it. What you're going to. I can see how that gets puts together with the battle to business plan, because, you know, you're thinking of it as a cerebral exercise. It makes a lot of sense to communicate with the client in that way when, yeah, you do have emotions tied up in these issues with businesses and people's personnel and things like that. So that makes sense.
I mean, it's hard in a client counseling context, which is, by the way, what I was told. Just tell your client to leave his emotions at the door. Yeah, right. But if you said, well, you know, there's a way to look at this like a business decision problem or like a decision problem, and here's this method, and now here's the map, and we can actually, we'll talk on, I know you asked, we can decide whether you do it in the moment or you bring it in, but here's a map and here's how it works. And now the two of us are working on that together. I'm bringing you into a language and a thought process that is just inherently about judgment and decision-making and not so much about, yes, but I hate him and I want, you know, it's just less about that. I will say, if we get into the discussion later, there are ways to account for emotions. Anyway, we'll talk more about that later.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the decision tree visual itself. Now, This is a visual plan, and obviously this is an audio podcast listening format. So for our listeners out there, can you paint a word picture for the audience? What does a decision tree look like?
Sure. I think you could think of trees and branches. So imagine that, you know, you start with what's the decision that I have to make? Should I do this or that? Should I file a lawsuit or not file a lawsuit? Should I settle or not settle? So you would have a little line that reflected the idea that I have a decision and I can go one way or another. And you would draw a little branch you'd make a split in the line, just like which direction can I go in? Let's assume, and this is the way that I usually use one in mediation, not always, it would be more a risk tree. So a decision tree is where I've got a decision to make and I have to figure out what will happen in either event. And there's obviously going to be some risk involved either way. When you get to the part of the tree where you don't control it, and all you're doing is not so much making decisions, but looking at the chances of things happen. Technically, that's the risk tree or risk part of a tree. And a litigation, with some exceptions, is really all about assessing risks and chances. And then you're looking at that risky part of life and you're weighing it against what your other options are. But that's a sort of a terminological distinction. But in any event, what you would do is you would say, well, okay, if I litigate, then you would have a litigation, you'd have a little line, and you would say, what's the series of questions that you draw out are, well, if we decide to litigate, what would happen next? What are the things that could happen next? And let's say that I know that the other side, I'm plaintiff and the other side has filed a motion for summary judgment, or a motion to dismiss, right? Then I would make a little two branches that said, you know, survive the motion to dismiss, not survive the motion to dismiss, right? And then at the end of the, if I'm on the branch that says, so I say, think of it this way, if I say, we don't have a tree, and I just say, so if we go forward and there's a motion to dismiss and the judge rules that yes, this case should be dismissed, then we would be at the end of that branch. Mm-hmm. Right. If we go forward and the judge doesn't dismiss the case, right, then here we are. And you would draw a little circle and you'd say, well, then what would happen after that? Right. And then there are detailed and less detailed ways to look at that. But you could say, well, I think that they're probably still going to, after discovery, they might file a motion for summary judgment. Right. Because dismiss is. So then you would say, well, what would happen on summary judgment? We could win or we could lose, right? Mm-hmm. If we lose on summary judgment, then the case is over. If we win on summary judgment or we survive summary judgment, then we have to look at what would happen if we went to trial. And so then you would have a line that says win and go to trial. And then you say, huh, what could happen at trial? Well, we could win or we could lose. And that would be a suit. And then if finally at the end, there would be, assume that we win at trial, what are we likely to collect in damages? And if we lose at trial, well, we get nothing. So that would be a super, super simple way to represent a case. And some cases would fall into that pretty simple plan where, you know, if I had a case where it was an action for breach of contract and there were liquidated damages and there was a possible motion to dismiss based on a release of claims, for example. So, you know, it gets dismissed or not based on the release of claims. It goes forward. I don't know, maybe they file a motion for summary judgment about something or another. If I survive that, then in that case, it's pretty easy because I either win or I lose. And if I win, I know that I get the liquidated damages. So that's pretty easy. I will say that in real life, most cases are more complicated, you know, would be more complicated than that. But that shouldn't be daunting. My big point is it shouldn't be daunting because all you're doing is drawing lines to represent what you would tell a client. Mm-hmm. So let's say that I have a case where there's been a motion for summary judgment filed. And I would do this in a mediation, by the way. So I'm in a mediation, I'm in joint session, and I would say to both counsel, so, okay, what if we don't settle here, what would happen next in this case? And somebody says, well, I'm going to file a motion for summary judgment. In fact, I've already sent him my draft. Okay, fine. And then I say, well, let me just ask, is this an all or nothing motion for summary judgment? Or is this one where you could imagine the judge saying summary judgment on these claims, but allowing some other claims to come through? So partial. And so then the lawyer, if I'm in a mediation and the lawyers can't answer that question, can even think about it, they haven't thought about it before. I have to tell you, I don't think much of the lawyers. They should have thought about that. Right. And so then they say, well, actually, yes,
a judge could knock the whole thing. Non-economic losses and,
exactly. A judge could knock the whole thing out. Or he could just knock out the fraud claims. Mm-hmm. Or he could just knock out whatever it is. And so then if that were true and you were drawing it on a tree, then you would have three branches, right? You'd be summary judgment granted, totally. Summary judgment denied, totally, or summary judgment on fraud claims only. Mm-hmm. If that was the logical way it would sort out. But what I'd like to say is, okay, so there would be three branches coming off my node on a decision tree. There would be three, you now have three branches. But that's not different than the lawyer saying in an opinion letter or just in a meeting or the mediator talking about, well, there are three ways this could go. But it's the same thing. You're just representing it as a visual.
And do you build the decision tree with the client or the mediating parties, or do you do it yourself and show your findings to them?
Let me break down that question a little bit. So first of all, whether you attempt to do a decision tree, as I would say, in the moment, has partially to do with how comfortable you are with drawing a tree, especially in a relatively complicated case. The more comfortable you are, the more there's no problem doing it on the spot. I would say, though, if there's a case, let's say you're mediating a case and you got either mediation briefs or people sent you copies of the summary judgment motions because they've already been filed or they're going to be filed. You know something about the twists and turns of the case, and it's not uncomplicated. Then I might, before I start mediating, sketch out the way I think this case might map, right? Because there's so many things going on in your brain in the mediation. But I probably wouldn't put on probabilities and dollar numbers. In fact, I shouldn't before I would start mediating. So I might come into the mediation with a structure, with the structure of the tree mapped out or at least sketched out in pencil, but you always have to be prepared for surprises. So a lot of times I will in joint session ask most of the questions that I would need to know the answers to figure out what the structure of the tree was. And, you know, if both sides are facing they're facing a court litigation, then the question of what could possibly happen is, at least on a surface level, pretty much the same for both sides. There are ways it wouldn't be, but mostly. So I will ask a bunch of those questions in joint session. And then I will probably, unless it's been prearranged, I would wait until the caucus session to draw the tree with each side separately. And I would, and usually, even if I've come in with a structure in my head based on what I've read, it's not at all uncommon, you still have to ask the questions. It's not at all uncommon for the structure even that you end up with to be different than the one you brought from home. Mm-hmm. You have a start. But the reason I wouldn't, you don't want to start with the probabilities. Maybe you'll ask me about probabilities. You don't want to start with those because that's really prejudging. And we all know, at least we all know, if you've mediated at all, that what you read in the mediation briefs can often look a lot different based on what you hear in the
mediation. Yeah. And so just talking through probabilities with the client can help probably show how complicated this issue is and how many different outcomes there could be that maybe the client themselves hadn't considered. Like, they are just like win lose. Well, you know, what's the probability of that? What are the intricacies that we could fall into? You know, being a trial attorney, you learn whatever you think is going to happen at trial that day, something's going to blow it up. Like, something's going to be different than what you thought. So,
yeah. I mean, actually, I think probabilities is a bit of a separate and complicated topic, how you come up with the probabilities that go on a tree. But I will say that, I can think of a really big case I did not long after arriving in Cincinnati, where there were about 100 plaintiffs. It wasn't a class action for various reasons, but there were about 100 plaintiffs. And I was in a so sometimes I'll do it there too. I was in a sort of big pre-mediation session, but big meeting with all of them. And I was there with the lawyers, and we had these big flip charts. So just the lawyers for the plaintiffs. And I asked them all those questions about, well, what would happen if this would happen, and what would happen if, and there were a whole, I mean, the case was really complicated, and there were a whole bunch of sort of procedural hurdles that would have to be jumped through. And then once you jumped through them, there were all sorts of questions relating to, to the weakness and strength of likely testimony, and then also and experts, and also a whole bunch of different ways that the damages could sort out. Just, it was really, really complicated. And I, in front of the plaintiffs, walked their lawyers through those questions, and I sort of drew as we went. And what we ended up with at the end was this hugely, like, lots of feathers, lots of little branches off of little branches. And we didn't have to do the math, because everybody could see, oh, this is complicated. Yes, at the top of that tree or somewhere, that's what I want. But there are any number of other ways that this could shake out, both losing altogether and different damages ranges. And that alone, forget the math, was enough to start the plaintiffs thinking more carefully about settlement.
That's great. Do you assign values, number values, amounts on these branches of the tree, like what the liability could be at different points?
Yes. So let me just say, I want to say the answer is yes. And you need the liabilities if you're going to do what's called a rollback or an estimated monetary value. And I can talk about that. But the answer is yes. As a mediator, I will say that one of the really nice things is, if you would rather not interject your own opinion about your evaluation of what you think the chances of winning or losing or their chances of this motion are, let's just say that as a matter of mediation practice, you either never want to do that, or you'd only want to do it as a last resort. Let's just say, because I've written a lot about evaluation and mediation. And although I'm not against it for religious reasons or anything, I do very much advise that if you're going to do it, there are ways to do it, and it should be way at the end. But the point is that you can draw a tree. The mediator draws the tree. You're in caucus. You're with the lawyer and client on one side. You say, well, let's see how I've asked all these questions in the joint session, and am I wrong that this is how it, and you introduce the idea of decision tree analysis, because it's a useful way to map out what might happen in a case. And then you start doing that, and you say, okay, based on what I heard in there, right, am I right that the next thing that would happen is summary judgment? And am I correct that we talked about the idea that summary judgment could actually go in sort of three basic ways? Yeah. And of course, if the judge didn't allow summary judgment at all, there's nothing got knocked out, then if you win the case, or if you lose, depending on what side I'm in, and the fraud, and there's a finding on fraud, or there could be a finding of no fraud. So I'd map it out, and then I'll ask the lawyer, okay, lawyer, what do you think are the chances of summary judgment of each of these things on summary judgment? If you are in the world where the judge allowed the fraud claims to go forward, you still have to prove them. Let's think about what evidence would be introduced at a trial where fraud was still alive, right? What do you think are the chances of winning or losing on liability in a case like that? And I ask the lawyer and I just insert the lawyer's percentages. I mean, I might discuss a little bit too, are you sure? But, and you know, all the way down the line, I will ask the lawyer what he thinks the probabilities are and to give me an estimate at the end of the line, if that happens and there's a fraud finding, mm-hmm. What's your best estimate of what the damages are? So now let's say that I do that with the lawyer and the client in the caucus. Two things are accomplished. One of them is super important. Well, both of them are super important. One is that there's now very clear communication between the lawyer and the client about what the lawyer really thinks of the case. Because sometimes what'll happen is a lawyer will say to his client, oh, I think we have a really great case, or that issue is really strong for us.
Right.
And the client thinks, I've done this. This happened to me one time in the Middlesex County Courthouse in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I'm in caucus with the lawyer and client in a construction case. And I say, so what do you think are your chances of succeeding on this case? And it was, you know, there wasn't much preliminary. He says, I think we have a really strong case. I said, no, I think I agree with you. So what do you think? What, you know, but what's your best estimate of the chances? And he says, I don't know, like 60% maybe. And the client looked at him and said, are you kidding? You told me it was a really good case. I thought that meant like 90 or 95%. I never would have invested this much in the case if I had known you thought 60%.
Awkward. Well, and in one of your articles, you said that respect for a client's risk tolerance is an important part of using decision tree analysis.
Right. So if
60% was not acceptable.
right. And we tend to mush those together, technical term. And if you talk to a client and you say, oh, I think we have a really strong case and it's worth rolling the dice. Well, now I'm substituting, without saying it, I'm substituting my risk tolerance for the client's. But there's a benefit to laying that bare and saying, I think the odds are this. Now you decide how comfortable you are with that. So clear communication is one big reason that I'm all in favor of giving probability estimates to your client. But the other thing I was going to say is that if you don't have numbers, probabilities and end numbers, then you can't roll back the tree. So I'm hoping you'll ask me what that means.
What is roll back the tree?
Well, it's really pretty simple. So if I say to you, you have a 50-50 chance of winning this coin toss of a case, right? And if you win, it's a liquidated damages claim, you're going to win $100,000. So what's that worth? I don't know, 50% of 100,000, right?
Sounds about right.
Worth $50,000. And I might settle it for a little less if I'm the plaintiff, because I'd rather have the bird in the hand. I'll take 40 out of 50, you know. But yeah, so it's basically the idea that when we make decisions, many of us, we look at, well, what might happen? What might I get or what might I lose at the end? It's like betting. Mm-hmm. And let me discount that by the likelihood that it will happen. So if I'm really sure, if I'm positive, I'm going to get $100,000 in this case. And if I'm really sure, it's a weighted coin, right? Litigation isn't always 50-50, that I'm so sure I'm going to get it, maybe 80%.
Right.
Well, then the discounted value of that super simple case would be $80,000.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere is it written, there's no commandment that says thou must settle the case for $80,000. But it is the EMV, the estimated monetary value, that what happens when you take what could happen and you multiply it by the likelihood that it will. Where it gets more complicated, but the logic is exactly the same, is if I have lots of probabilities stacked along the way. Mm-hmm. So let's say I have a case where I'm a plaintiff and I think I have an 80% chance of surviving summary judgment. And then say a 80% chance of winning at trial. Okay, so that's 0.8 times 0.8 is 0.64. So that means, well, I really only have a 64% chance of getting something. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Actually, so so you're just basic, I mean, you're taking all the things that might happen and you are multiplying them by the likelihood that they will happen. And that is what the rollback calculation on a case is. And it's, I mean, that's what it is. There's more of that, the more complicated your tree, but it's arithmetic. And, you know, you can do it on a spreadsheet or if you have a software, you know, it'll calculate it for you. And that has a value that for some clients, that has a value because, do you want me to tell you what the value is? Why that helps?
Go ahead. Please.
So if I have a tree, a medium complicated tree, and I have someone who says, I have this fabulous case, I'm the plaintiff, and, you know, I'm not taking less than $500,000 this case because, you know, they're evil, they're rot, whatever they're saying. And I sit with the plaintiff and his lawyer or her lawyer, and we figure out, you know, we together say, well, what are the chances of this motion and what are the chances of this and what are we, and we do all it all out. And I use the lawyer's numbers and I use the lawyer's best estimates for the probabilities, which are probably going to be a little optimistic, but let's say I do that and I roll back the tree and I get an estimated monetary value of, I don't know, 225. Well, it's, and let's say I could settle the case for, you know, believe me, that'll be no problem. Right. But it's hard, you know, it's hard to argue with that. Well, gee, I put in all your inputs. We didn't even argue about whether that's optimistic. And I'm coming out with an EMV with a rollback number, you know, that a computer would take data on Star Trek.
Right.
Listen to this, right?
It's logical.
So it's a business, you can frame it as a business judgment, right?
Right.
It is that. And so that creates some movement. Because those are their inputs. And there are lots of ways you can work with that with a client.
Right.
The only other thing I guess I wanted to say about probabilities and calculations and clients' willingness to settle is a lot of times for a client, you know, when you do an EMV for a whole case, you get a number and it is the discounted value for the case. Okay. It's basically, if we were to have Groundhog Day and try the case 100 times,
yeah,
that's the average, you know, that's the weighted average of all of what would happen every time. But the truth is, unless you have a very repeat player client,
of course,
they're not going to do it 100 times.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But on the right hand margin of the cases or of the tree is where you have, you know, here's this outcome. We could get high punitives. We could get medium punitives. Mm-hmm. You could get low. There could be no punitive damage finding, in which case we're talking about the actual damages. And, you know, there are certain things that could happen here, or we could get a cheap jury, or we could lose on liability, or we could have lost at a preliminary stage. So I've got all those outcomes are sort of stacked up on the right-hand side of the tree. And for each one of them, you can tell what the cumulative probability is, which is a fancy way of saying, well, here are the possible things that could happen. And here are the chances of each one of them happening. Because that's what we want to know. What could happen? And what are the chances of this, that, this, and that happening? And that's how I decide.
Right.
And so that's, you know, it can be really useful for the client to see that.
Well, and as you say, the client could have a completely different risk tolerance and want to go for something higher. They are there. It's worth it to them to
right
that probability, but that's their choice.
Right. Well, and actually, and on the, I'm sorry, I interrupted
and
you.
And it helps them make that choice that to see right. it all written out like that with all right. the possibilities. And then they'll never be able to say, well, you didn't tell me.
You know, I think that's hugely important. I really do, for the lawyer to be able to say, well, you know, I put it on the tree.
You saw that tree.
It wasn't a high probability, but it was there. Yeah. I think that's actually, I think that's a reason that I'm a proponent of learning how to do it. And if it's a complicated case with a lot of possible outcomes, making sure that you take the time to put them in and not just you know, brush over them. The other thing I was going to say, so if you look at this from the defense side and risk tolerance, I mean, one of the things that's true sometimes is you can have a case where you say, well, if you just look at this range of outcomes, you know, 30, 40% of the time you're home free, we do have to calculate in the attorney's fees, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about that. You will have to pay something to get there on the defense side, but okay, you know, you would have paid $50,000 to your attorney between now and then. And let's say there's a 40% chance that that's it. And let's say that if you net out all the things that might happen, you know, about 30% of the time, that looks like the damages are going to be somewhere between, you know, $150,000, $450,000, which is not nothing.
Right, of course.
But then there's these somewhere between 25 and 30% of the time, the damages end up at over $1 million. Actually, between $1 and $3 million. I'm making this up. So then the client can say, oh, well, my business won't be happy, but I've got a line of credit and I could survive if the damages come in here, but not if they come in.
Or bankrupt if it hits that. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, and by the way, I mean, that's right. And so for the client, you know, it prompts a conversation about that.
Yeah.
It also, by the way, depending on the kind of case that you have, if you have a case where I'm concerned, there could be an injunction that I have to take my product off the shelves, right? There are things like that. Well, it also, if there's a significant chance that something rotten like that might happen, then maybe the client has a way to alter his business setup or her business setup. To be able to handle that. I mean, it depends on the circumstances and the type of case because, you know, it's money damages are not the only thing that can happen. I mean, in an employment case, is there a chance of reinstatement? How rotten would that be? Can you quantify that? Maybe you can't, but we could write it down. So the act of drawing it and writing those things down makes the future possibility real. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of a lawyer's job is to help a client see that, well, whichever way it unfolds, even if it'll be a while from now, that would be real, whatever it is. And it's worth taking a moment or two to think about how will I deal if that's the reality. And I think that's a good thing for a lawyer to do with the client.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this just enables, it slows down the discussion and enables a sort of visual on it.
Now, many longtime mediators might feel like they have a gut sense about how a case should be valued. Would you recommend going through a decision tree analysis, even if you, as a very experienced mediator, feel like you have a handle on the case and you don't want to do a lot of math?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, at some level, what's interesting to me is sometimes I'll have a gut sense of a case like, oh, you know, and then I'll do a tree. And you know, the tree comes out kind of sort of about what I thought. Well, great. I'm more confident, you know.
Hey.
Yeah. But sometimes what happens is it doesn't. And what, you know, look, if I say to you, you know, there's this chance of that, and this chance of that, and this could unfold that way. And then there's that expert thing, and we don't know if that expert's going to be qualified. If I kind of go through all the things that could happen, and I do that in words to you, and I say, okay, so now what's the settlement value of the case? We can't do that. Yeah. Our brains don't do it.
Right.
Right. So deconstructing each step, putting your best judgment into each piece of it, I don't think there's a substitute for it. So it's really, it's real. What it does is enforces a rigorous thought process that can be a check on your gut when your guts aren't so rigorous.
Are there problems that can come up in a mediation that a decision tree can help fix? So like say you have a client who is not conceding anything, not going anywhere, just being difficult. Can the decision tree be a tool to move that mediation along?
Yeah, I mean, that's really why I use it, in fact, is, number one, if the reason nothing's moving is because the client is it's all about how much I hate the fellow.
But it looks like it's about that. Yeah.
It isn't going to end well, right? Then, yeah, I'm trying to get them into that mode of thinking about things more carefully and more rationally. And I can also, so that's a short answer. Sometimes there's a sort of strategic negotiating way. So again, if I have a tree and I build it on the lawyer's assessment, I can say, well, it rolls back to this. You're over here. How can I sell that to them? Even if they, you know, how can I sell that to the other side? But also I can say, well, you know, I'm not saying you have to settle for that. You don't. But anything less than that or more than that or whatever side you're on seems like it would be a bargain, right? Seems like it would be a really good deal. So that can help. Sometimes you have circumstances, it's funny, where, believe it or not, a tree can help you with an emotional client. So I'm thinking of a case I did a long time ago involving, this horrible death, like this couple, they were in their 60s, they were caretakers at some historical building society, something, and the wife slipped on a stair something, marble stairs, broke her neck, was in a calocast for 6 months, and then died.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, it doesn't get worse, right? It just doesn't get worse. Yeah. And there was a threshold question of whether a charitable limitation under state law would apply, which would have been $40,000, which the insurance company, not surprisingly, was willing to pay. And if they got by that, there were some real liability questions. Without going into it, there just were some real uncertainties around liability. But everyone agreed the damages were huge. And there were two problems in that case. One was for the insurance company. Well, I offer $40,000. Yeah, damages could be, you know, how many millions of dollars, but I don't know how the heck to value this case. So being able to roll it back helped him say to his supervisor, yeah, that made sense. But on the plaintiff side, on the emotion side, it was so interesting. The husband, nice man, the husband of the woman that died, felt like if he settled for, you know, $200,000, $300,000, whatever it worked out to be, not something in the millions, that he was somehow devaluing his wife and her life and her suffering and all. And so we were able to say to him, look on the tree. Everybody agrees that if you succeed in this case, the damages, the value, you can't put a value on your wife's life, but it would be, you know, $3 million. It would be a huge number. And we had that on the tree. And he actually took some comfort in that it was counted.
Right.
And he could see that it was counted. It seems odd, but it can help. Yeah.
That's nice.
That helped move everybody.
Yeah. What are some good resources if the listeners to this podcast want to learn more about decision tree analysis?
I will tell you, but before I do that, I have to say one thing, can I say one thing so I'm not accused of decision tree malpractice?
Yes.
And that is that I will say two things. One, I think any lawyer has to be super careful when putting probabilities on a tree.
Okay.
So, because, you know, we all suffer, most of us, from partisan perception bias. So if you're on one side of a case, you're likely to be more optimistic than about your outcome. So in a lot of cases that mediators mediate, both sides think their chances of success are 75% or more, and they're going to succeed on that counterclaim. So the cumulative chances of success, if you added both sides, are more than 150%. That can't be true. So I am a firm believer in a couple of ways to compensate for that. One is to try to look at databases to see, well, in this jurisdiction, how often is summary judgment granted in a case like mine? Okay. That doesn't mean that you have to take that statistic, but you might have to justify why my case is stronger or weaker than that. Mm-hmm. So that becomes a neutral anchor to help you. It also is helpful, of course, to get other opinions about what the chances are. And I think it's also useful to play around with a little bit. Well, I, you know, on a good day, think this is maybe I've got an 80% chance of succeeding here. But let's see what happens with the tree if it's 70. Because nobody knows. Right. It's not like you say there is a 70% winning. it's just my best estimate. And so I really advise you to do that. And by the way, with the lawyer, if a mediator is going to be weighing in and saying, well, here's what I think, you know, you can have a dialogue about, well, I think the damages are this, and gosh, I'd put my percentage around here. It's not my case. You know it better than I do. So humility is good. But then you can talk about that and say, well, let's play with it on the tree. What happens if we use this percentage, but these damages? So it allows dialogue. But I forget what was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, I think that's the thing I needed to say about be careful about the probabilities that you use and don't be so sure of the probabilities. I had to put that in order to not be guilty of
malpractice. Yeah, no, we don't want decision tree malpractice committed as a result of this podcast.
But meanwhile, you had asked me about resources, I think.
Yes, where do they go to learn more?
So I'm going to first plug the pioneer in the field. There's a man named Mark Victor, who's been writing and training in decision tree analysis for a long time. I knew his work when I first started in this field. And he has a website, and if you Google Mark Victor and decision tree analysis, I think his articles are just great. And they do take you through the how you do it. And if I'm allowed a plug for my risk and rigor book.
Of course, I was going to.
Yeah, so the book, and the reason I can plug it without guilt is because you can actually get it for free. So the book is called Risk and Rigor, A Lawyer's Guide to Assessing Cases and Advising Clients. And it's published by Dispute Resolution Institute Press. And they have which is based out of Mitchell Hamlin Law School. And they have a policy that anything they publish has to be available for free download chapter by chapter as PDFs. That's not always how they do it, but that's how mine is. So if you went to the Dispute Resolution Institute Press website and you put in risk and rigor, you should come up with my book and you could download the chapters for free. The other thing I guess I would say is the first about three chapters of the book are about basic logic and just this really simple how-tos. And then it goes on to say, well, let's say your case is a little more complicated. There are some judgment calls on how you construct a tree, but I'm trying awfully hard to walk you through it. And the thing I do want to say is that I've learned from teaching this, because I teach a basic unit on it in a course at UC Law that at least half of our students end up taking. There's no substitute. If this stuff is hard for you, there's no substitute, I've learned, for sort of seeing somebody say, and so here's the problem, and here's how you would draw it, and here's you do this, and here's how you sort of by hand calculate the math. For some reason, a lot of us need to see that to absorb it. And so there is a website called riskandrigor.com, and it has in it, there's some problems in the book. And in the book, it says, how do you do this? Imagine you do that. And then it shows you the tree in print. But the website has little videos on it so that if you wanted to see the process of getting to that hand-drawn, very with great difficulty on some pad that I did, and you'll hear my voice. So it really is designed to walk you through some super simple exercises in how you would draw a tree and then how you would calculate the basic math on a simple tree. So I suggest that. And then if you really wanted to get the hard copy printed version, that's on Amazon. And it's, I think, $28.95 or something like that. I wanted to make it affordable. But even if you did that, if you got the print version, then you would still, if you think that you would like to see the really basic stuff done hand-drawn, then you would go to the website and you'd be able to see those little videos that take you through.
That's a great idea. That's great that you can get walked through that like that. I love that.
I tried.
All right.
There's also actually on the website, now that I think about it, I've got a couple of videos. I have one new I can plug. A video of me presenting it a couple ways in a couple different classes that I videotaped at UC. But then I also recently put up a video showing Kelly Malloy Myers and Carrie Atkins-Barron from Freaking Myers and Rule, where we set it. I mean, I created the video, but Kelly is walking her client through a client counseling session in preparation for a mediation in an employment case. That doesn't feature so much the technical aspects of how you would build the tree, but it shows you a little bit about how you might introduce it to the idea of it to a client. So we filmed that about a year ago, and I just put it up on that website.
I love that. That's great. Well, is there any other thoughts on decision tree analysis that we didn't get to today that you were like, I have to say this to them before we go?
I know what I was going to say. Wait, two things.
Okay.
One, there is a soft, Excel has a decision tree add-on, which is not bad. And it's either free or not expensive at all. The software that I have long used is called Triage. It was developed by a lawyer named Morris Raker and the teenage whiz kid down the block who later got a JD MBA named David Hoffer, who's also written some really nice things in this field. But Triage was founded by Morris and David and is in now Western Massachusetts, but is used more for health policy stuff. They do have a version of the software, which is not set up for health policy, but it works, but it's not cheap. Oh, and the other one, here's a good one. There's which I meant to mention, you had asked, there's a really wonderful mediator named Dan Klein, who's in Georgia, and he has a website called Klein ADR, and he has he uses decision trees. I'm happy to say I introduced him, but he kind of ran with it. He uses decision trees in mediation, and he has put up on his website resources, including a template for a very basic employment case. So I would say, and that resource is free. So I would say go to Klein ADR and take a look at the decision tree portion of his site. He's a terrific mediator, and he sometimes uses decision trees in mediation.
Great. Those are great resources. Well, we are nearing the end of our podcast, and there is a bit that I like to do at the end of every podcast, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. I will have two questions for you, Professor, and one question that you can give to our audience as a pop quiz to see if they were paying attention today. So the first question is, what's an interesting and relatively brief mediation related story that you can share?
Well, I think I gave you one of them, but actually I can give you another one. I had a case a while back involving a guy who was a Vietnam vet, but he was functioning, and he was employed in some kind of group home as a, and he got an electric shock from an electric stove and thought he was having a heart attack and ended up with PTSD and was not able to function on his own anymore. The amazing thing is that the insurance company agreed with that. There was no faking here. And he was in a compromised position. He couldn't stay in the mediation that long. So we did a morning session. And after it was done, I did a decision tree on the case because there were issues of foreseeability and damages. And it was just a bizarre case. And I needed to do it to wrap my head around it, which is what I tell my students, do one to just wrap your head around it. And I ended up, and I don't remember, the negotiations had gotten to a certain place and we took a break. And I ended up calling the lawyer for the insurance company. It was actually a captive insurer, insurance defense firm for this electric company. And we were talking about the case, and I said, I did a decision tree in this case. And he said, I did too. And I said, sort of like, well, if you show me yours, I'll show me yours. So we talked about it. And, it was such a bizarre case. We were not that far off. I had chances of liability a little bit higher than his, and he had chances a little bit lower, and I had the damages a little bit higher. I mean, he was a defense lawyer and he had them a little bit lower, but nobody was sure. You would have been crazy to think that even though you came up with a probability that you were, it could have been a pretty wide swing even on the judgment. So we said, well, let's see what would happen if we took your damages number and my probability. And we played with that, we rolled it black and got a certain number. And then we said, what say if we did it the other way? And it was a really interesting, delightful dialogue to have with defense counsel, because I wasn't just trying to pull money out of him.
Right, right.
He wasn't stonewalling, and we weren't playing, you know, it was kind of great. And what it did, though, is create movement for him and the ability, because he couldn't be sure and neither could anybody. It allowed him to move and to justify to his client why he moved and feel okay about it, not feel like feeling like, oh, I moved up by, you know, from 275 to 350 because the lawyer, the mediator or the other side strong-armed me or begged me and I caved in. I mean, it wasn't about that at all. Mm-hmm. And so it worked really nicely in case that's a happy ending.
That's great. Yeah. All right. Question two is who is an amazing person you know related to the field of mediation and why do you appreciate them or decisions?
Well, I was going to give you Dan Klein, actually.
Dan Klein. Shout out to Dan Klein and his awesome website. And
I have to also maybe mention my friend and colleague, Dwight Golan, who in many ways, he's been less of a I love decision tree person than I have, but he seems to respect it. And he has been gracious enough to co-author with me a number of articles. A number of articles in various places. He's often the one that says, oh, let's write a chapter or let's write an article or I'll put this in my book. In fact, his mediation book, Mediating Legal Disputes, is the first thing I ever wrote in. And it was the first time I ever wrote a chapter about decision trees. So Dwight is the one that has convinced me that sometimes using a scratch pad or an Excel spreadsheet isn't so terrible. And he's come along, I think, with the idea that there are some benefits to doing it out, in a visual way. So I have appreciated his willingness to include my passion for decision trees and to work with me on that.
That's great. All right, your chance to give the audience a knowledge check. What is a pop quiz question that they should be able to answer after listening to this podcast?
Well, I guess I would ask them, what's more likely to be persuasive to a client, the ultimate EMV rollback or what you see on the right-hand side, which is the outcomes and their probabilities? Mm-hmm. If they understand that question and can answer it, I think they listened.
All right. Good things to think about. All right. Any closing words before we sign off today?
I hope that people will, a lot of lawyers are math phobic. I went to law school because I didn't want to do the math. And I just am strong on the idea that a decision tree analysis arithmetic is not a bar. First of all, it's only arithmetic. It's really about clear thinking and logic and forcing yourself to break down what you think is going to happen in the case. You can do that without the math. I think verbal analytical thinkers ought to be able to do that. And so it's really about mapping clear, detailed thinking. So it should not feel foreign to someone who's math phobic. For the purposes of the calculation, you could either not do it or get someone else to do it for you. But that's what I hope is that no one will say, oh, gosh, that's math. I don't like math. And I would say, by the way, that we use math all the time, even if we don't admit it. So someone will say, I have a really strong case on liability and I'm going to settle. I think we should settle it for X. And then the expert deposition comes and the case gets worse. And you say, oh, well, in view of that, I think maybe we should think about settling it for Y. You are internally using math as a discount factor. You're just not admitting it to yourself. So again, I don't think the math phobic should be put off. I think it's about rigorous thinking. I think it's an enormous help for client communication, for mediators and for lawyers and clients.
That's good. My dad always used to have to tell me math is your friend because I was so scared of it. So I'm hearing those same words from you today, backing him up. Okay. All right, well, that's a wrap for today. A huge thank you to Professor Marjorie Corman Aaron for sharing your practical advice and for helping to reach resolutions with us today. And thank you to everyone out there listening. We hope you will join us for the next episode of Civility and Solutions. And until then, keep working for justice.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.